On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we've got some good news for a change. We want to go through our holiday wish list, and Raphael scares the pants off us once again. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 72, recorded December 20th, 2013, for December 23rd, 2013. Beacon Beachhead. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballas here, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And we've got a special Christmas edition of TWiT for all the good boys and girls. Now, if you haven't been a good boy or girl, please go someplace else. But if you stay here, please say hello to my good friend and co-host, Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise, who is wearing a most festive hat. Cheebert, how you doing?
I am doing just peachy and just cleaning up some of the mess of one of my researchers coming in from China that got hit by a man-in-the-middle attack and just trying to make sure that our systems weren't wide open during his visit.
Yeah, isn't that fun when people come bearing gifts like Trojan horses? But you know who isn't a Trojan horse? Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, it's late over in the East Coast, and yet you bring us so much light. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing well, Padre. When we're recording this, it's nice and warm here in the swamp, and promises to be that way when this show goes live as well. All is right in the world when I can wear shorts and a pocket tee for my holiday garb.
And you just come up with our show title, Shorts and a Pocket Tee. Let's get right into the Enterprise Bite. Later on, we've got Raphael Mudge coming back to complete his Scaring the Pants Off You series of holiday episodes. But before that, we want to give you some nice stories, some stories that maybe might restore some of the warmth that has been socked out of your soul by NSA spying and such. And that is that Google is actually trying to help you. They're trying to keep your images from spying on you. Now, Cheebert, have you heard about this before? This is how marketers use images to check to see whether or not you're opening it. This is how they can come back to their clients and say, we have a 1% open rate or a 10% open rate. Essentially, they give every single email a unique file address, file name, so that if that image gets called, they know that that email has been read. Do you play with that at all?
Well, of course. Why do you think all my email clients are set so they don't open the images first?
Right, right.
You know, so I get this. All I get is this frame and so forth. And if I like that marketer, fine, I'll load the images, but only if I like them.
Now, you and I know to do that. We know to turn off auto images, but a lot of people don't, especially those who are using Gmail. So what Google did is they've now reset the system to automatically download all images to their servers so that when you look at that image, when you read that email, you're not calling back to the marketer's computer. You're actually just calling it from the Google cached image. Now, the cool thing about this is to the marketer, it will look like every single email they've ever sent to a Gmail address has been opened, which means that it will make that data useless. Curtis, let me throw this over to you. It is kind of gleeful to think of, you know, messing around with people who could be associated with spam. But at the same time, this is a legitimate metric, right? I mean, when you think about the new economy, we kind of need to know whether or not our efforts on the internet are working. Oh, you're muted.
My apologies. You're quite correct. This is one of the basic metrics. I know when Enterprise Efficiency does direct email campaigns to our list of the people who have opted into such things, we look at open rates to tell whether people are interested in certain types of email, certain types of subject lines, for example, or certain types of initial lines. it's one of those basic tools that the direct marketing people have been using for a long time. Once upon a time, it was the response rate, how many people sent back in the postcard that you sent out, how many people circled the little number on the card that was shoved into the magazine for the advertising response. Today, we look at things like open rates for email. And if we don't have that, then you can bet that somewhere out there, there is a chief marketing officer looking at other technology that, frankly, might even be more intrusive to return the same kind of data.
Achiever Kirok in the chat room gives a good point, which is, look, many small businesses need good customer data. If they're going to compete in any usable way with the big boys, they kind of depend on these data points in order to know if their very targeted marketing is hitting the right people. Is Google really doing a favor for us, or are they just ensuring that only the big boys can afford to do marketing across social media?
Nah, they're just making everybody buy Google ads.
Okay, so that's the one way that they'll be able to get you on Gmail.
Yeah, well, hey, unfortunately, a lot of the tools, either you're a big boy or you've got to go and buy into a service. A lot of the old tricks, because of the massive amounts of spam and the phishing and all this stuff, the hackers really have done a big, bad number to small business. You know, that's really the bottom line. It's only the big players can afford to play now, because the small players have been, you know, basically pushed out of the market because of the hackers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's move on to our next warm and fuzzy enterprise bite. This one is kind of complicated, but not really. You see, a while back when the NSA spying issue came to light, President Obama appointed an independent counsel to find out what's going on and what we should be doing. They came back with their recommendations, and I've got to say, it actually looks pretty decent. They did a really thorough examination of all the different intelligence gathering techniques that we've been using over the last few years, especially the ones that the NSA has used to look at foreign nationals and to look at citizens within the United States. They recommended a few things, but some of the highlights are, number one, that the NSA should not be gathering, that they should end as expeditiously as possible their collection of all the metadata. That's email headers and phone call numbers, if they're not keeping the content. By estimations, over a trillion different data points. They say that that should be phased out as soon as possible. They also suggested that if we want to continue to have that capability to look back in time and collect those data points, it should be done by a third party. Specifically, they're looking at the telcos, they're looking at the ISPs, asking them to maintain that data so that if there is an actual threat that needs to be examined, there can be a court order obtained. They can go back, look at that third party, request just those records, and continue their investigation. Chibert, first impressions, what do you think about these recommendations? I haven't had a chance to go through the entire White House report, but it looks like they're at least starting on the right path by saying the days of warrantless tapping need to be over.
We all know how much I rant about, you know, this and that and that and this, but, you know, it just needs to have common sense applied to it. And what I'm starting to read is like, okay, maybe someone actually has their head screwed on straight as they're writing some of these rules. Fine. I want my intelligence agencies to be able to do their job and to protect me and protect my way of life. But for God's sakes, don't make it easy to abuse. And I'm starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And to the NSA, thank you for being a little more reasonable.
Curtis, let me throw over to you, because the panel suggested that the FBI need obtain judicial approval before using any national security letter, and that they wanted to remove the post facto practice of doing surveillance and then getting approval for it after the fact. They also said that the FISA courts will continue, and the FISA courts can grant court orders per number when reasonable suspicion arises. So on that sense, I'm not quite sure if the panel goes far enough, because they're saying, yes, you must receive a court order, but then they're also saying the secret courts can continue to grant those court orders. And I don't actually see anything here that puts a level of oversight onto those FISA courts. What's your take?
Well, I actually heard a very good idea from an advocate of privacy. The attorney, Alan Dershowitz, made the suggestion that what the FISA court truly needs and doesn't have right now is a core of security-cleared lawyers that can be essentially defense lawyers. In other words, these would be attorneys who would oppose the warrants. They would have gone through the security screening. They would have clearance. But their job would be essentially to keep the agencies, the prosecutors, and the courts themselves honest, to make sure that there is some voice being heard that is in favor of privacy rather than going in and essentially saying yes to everything because they're only hearing one side of the story. To me, that would be the kind of fundamental change that we really need. These are some steps, and I'll say that any step is one in the right direction. I'm just not positive that what we're seeing here is going to have a material effect on just how much surveillance is being done.
I like that. It reminds me of the old trust but verify. Now, one last bit, and there have been a few people in the chat room who have been pointing this out, including Nexus 5. There was a story in The Verge about the NSA paying $10 million to install a backdoor into RSA security. The panel also addressed that, saying they want a prohibition on government subversion of commercial software, installing a backdoor, or undermining encryption software. And essentially, the panelists said, look, people have the right to encrypt what they want to encrypt and not worry that the government, the people they're supposed to be trusting, have put a backdoor to subvert that encryption. I actually like that. Chibert, do you think that's clear enough? There wasn't any solid recommendation. It was just the sort of the panel saying, look, you got to do this. If you want the trust back, you got to do it. But it didn't say, we demand you have this regulation, this rule, and this person to oversee.
You know, it's common sense. I'm going to be a broken record on this. You know, if you start doing stupid things and screwing over the general public, the backlash is they're going to call their legislatures and representatives and so forth and say, stomp on the NSA. Now, if the NSA is more reasonable about it and strikes more of a balance, then, you know, I don't mind so much. You know, I'm going to rant less.
Ratless. Got it. I think all three of us can agree that this is good. This is movement in the right direction. But all of our de facto stances are just encrypt. Encrypt everything. Encrypt your shopping list. Encrypt the important data. Encrypt your non-important data. If we all encrypted, it would make the NSA actually have to work to build that surveillance society. And wouldn't that be a Christmas miracle? Now, let's get on to a fun little thing we do at the end of the year, and that is choosing our Christmas gifts. We've got a couple of geek gifts. Chibert, I want to let you start off because you brought this up. I kind of like this. What is this thing you're having me look at?
Okay, so it's a Kickstarter project. I love Kickstarter. I'm addicted to Kickstarter. But these guys out of Utah, I believe, came up with this really cool new printhead for a 3D printer. It actually can replace the printhead on something like a MakerBot or whatever. And unlike a lot of other printheads, this guy can actually print using plastic welding rod. That thing that's going down into the bottom, that's plastic welding rod. So I can actually print using things like polycarbonate and some other types of thermoplastics that are completely unheard of and usually can only use with a really, really expensive printer. So now with a $2,000 MakerBot Replica 2, which is I'm hoping to buy as long as I have enough money, and that way I can actually print polycarbonate parts, which are great because I can start using those 3 miles underwater on my observatory and save myself. Basically, a polycarbonate part that I can print is going to be from 1/10 to 1/50th the cost of getting it custom made at a service house.
I like that. Yeah, I think what we're seeing a motion in these 3D printers is moving away from sort of the novelty printing to actually printing parts with enough strength and enough stability to have a real world use. I love this. Now, if people want to find out about this, where should they go?
Well, Kickstarter is where the printhead is, and basically all I did was I just email the guy and say, hey, I'm thinking about buying a replicator too. Is your printhead going to work with it? And he says, well, we've tested with these printers and life has been
good.
That
looks really good. Wow,
they actually have two different sizes. Really, they have good. A NEMA 17 and a NEMA 23. And the NEMA 23 can go to really, really thick rod, whereas the NEMA 17, it's, you know, the 3 millimeter, 3.5 millimeter stuff.
Not bad. Not bad. And let's continue the 3D printer craze, because Curtis, your Christmas gift was also 3D printer related.
Oh, absolutely. Mine is for a slightly different purpose. I don't have an underwater observatory. I do, however, have a wife who is an artist, and I would like to be able to create pieces of small wearable jewelry that would complement what she does. In order to do that, I need a pretty good little 3D printer that I can use to make positives for what will ultimately be some lost wax metal casting. The one that I looked at is the Lulzbot. Basically, any of the major 3D printers would work. I just thought we'd bring a little diversity into the discussion and look at that. Now, with that said, I have to admit that if I have one of the things, I'm going to use it for a lot more. For example, I'm a big GoPro fan for my outdoor adventures, making mounts for that thing, making various camera mounts for other types of cameras and shooting. Once you have a 3D printer, I have a feeling that it's not going to just sit there gathering dust very much. And definitely having one of these beasts is on my I've been a very good boy Christmas list. And fortunately, my spouse has started coming up with some great ideas for what she would like to see printed out as well.
Okay. All right. So you've got two printer bots. I went in a slightly different direction. If I could only get one thing for Christmas, I wanted it to be this thing. Okay, this 50-pound boat anchor thing. You've probably seen this if you've watched Twyatt a little bit, and if you've seen my Before You Buy review. This is actually the new version of their N2. This is now the IOSAVE 214. You might remember this review, Brian, if you could fast-forward that in a couple minutes. Right, the N2 was built on the Synology 213, putting it inside this really, really cool bulletproof, fireproof, waterproof, environment-proof, disaster-proof container surrounded by ceramic to give it a nice impact resistance, to give it a resistance to being shocked, being thrown, being dropped, even being burned and run over by a tractor. Now, the cool thing about these units is that it uses a Synology at its heart, which means it's fast. In fact, Patrick Norton and I both have this unit. We both found it to be one of the fastest pieces of gear that we've had in the lab. What I like about the 214 is it's just a tiny bit faster than the 213 than the 213 based unit I already have, and I can use a Synology client to sync between the two. So I'm actually going to put this thing in one of my colos and have it sync up with the one that's in my house, meaning that I'm going to have two complete copies that are always in sync, one which is a couple of hundred miles away. One of the other things I really like about the Synologies and the IOSAFE within the Synologies is that the third-party support for plugins is endless. One of the things that I was looking at doing with my 214 is there is a client that will do auto encryption, so I could actually use it to make sure that traffic going to a particular server on the internet is passing through here, getting encrypted without me having to worry about getting snooped on. Now, Chibert, have you played with any of these IOSAFEs at all?
Actually, I think I have that exact N version of the N2, and whoa, that's going to go home with me so I can start putting all my taxes and my photos and so forth. And you betcha I'm going to be using the auto encryption, and then I'm also going to be doing an auto backup to Amazon Glacier.
Now, I should point out that I've been testing this unit. I don't know if you could see it. There's a little teeny tiny dent right here. And that was actually the unit getting hit by a car. So when I say durable and disaster-proof, I really mean durable and disaster-proof. But that's our Christmas list of goodies. That's what we want to get. So if any of you want to send the Twyatt crew some goodies, a 3D printer, a disaster-proof hard drive, well, you know to find us, 140 Color Street, Petaluma, California. Probably not going to happen. All right. That's all right. Now, let's bring in our guest. We've got Raphael Mudge, who is going to tell us a little bit about How do I call this, Raphael? Beacon? What is Beacon?
Sure. So I mentioned earlier that I work on a product called Cobalt Strike, and Beacon is what we call a payload. It's what gets delivered to a compromised system, and it provides a penetration tester with a lot of covert communication options.
I see. Now, when you talk about covert communication options, what you're really saying is a way to communicate within a compromised network that's not readily detectable by the usual tools we would use for detecting intrusion detection, intrusion prevention.
Yeah, that's correct. And the reason for something like this existing is there's two kinds of penetration testing. In one form, an expert comes in, tries to find your vulnerabilities, and tell you which things you need to fix, kind of giving you a list of priorities of what you want to look at. In a more mature security program, you might bring in a penetration tester for what we call a red team assessment. And their job is to look at your controls, your intrusion detection, your malware analysis, all the things you might do to try to detect a threat once a system's been compromised. And that's where Beacon comes in. It allows you to effectively do that, to say, how good are we at catching a hard-to-detect threat?
I like that. Okay, so let me set up the scenario, because we always use our 10,000-seat enterprise network. We've got our network. It's more or less set up correctly. It's using perimeter defense, so we've got a firewall that's screening. And we even look at traffic inside the network to make sure that, say, no one is doing peer-to-peer file sharing, or that no one's using bots within the network, reaching out to a command and control node. You're saying there's a way around that using, well, typical protocols in order to send my attack traffic.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me take you through kind of a scenario, right? If I have a workstation and that workstation connects to a website, that's not strange, is it?
Right. So it just looks like HTTP traffic.
Right. Now, let's say that same workstation connects to your domain controller over SMB. Looks like it's connecting to a share. Is that strange?
Not at all. I mean, I would just think that that's typical traffic I would see in my network. It's either looking for a DNS resolution, or it's looking to set up some sort of Samba communications.
Right. And so this is what Beacon does. This covert communication payload I've written hides in plain sight. It uses these protocols to communicate and allows the attacker to set up their communication in such a way that they're always using a protocol that would make sense at a given point. If I have a compromised workstation, it can talk to me, the attacker, over the web or DNS. And if I want to communicate with a compromised server inside the network, I can do it through a compromised workstation over what looks like Windows file sharing traffic.
Nice. I like that. Chibert, just listening to what Raphael has described so far, how much does that scare you as an administrator? Because I know you, sitting over a very large network, you're always looking at your tools, at your monitors. If suddenly we've got a new style of attack that can use commonly known protocols like SMB, like DNS, to send attack traffic or CNC traffic through, that makes it undetectable by anything you've got in your lab right now, yes?
No, actually. Some of the newer deep packet inspection actually goes and disassembles the packet. So even if it is masquerading, it can still find it. What it does do is it makes a lot of the monitoring tools blind, basically, because they only really look at the headers.
Right.
So it can still be stopped, but it's going to be darn hard.
Okay. All right. So, Raphael, take us through this attack. Show me exactly what it does and how you set it up.
Okay. So give me just a moment here, and I'm going to bring up my screen. So let me go to Google Hangouts. And there we go, screen share. And let me give you desktop number 2. Okay. We looking good? Can you see me out there?
Hey, how about that? All right.
Excellent. Okay. Now, this is really going to be a fun demo, because I have right here Cobalt Strike connected to Amazon's Elastic Computing Cloud. This entire demo is going to take place over the internet as you'd expect it to work in real life, okay? Which is very strange for hacker demos. They're not usually done that way.
Right.
The other thing I want you to notice, right here, this is EtherApe, and it's a tool that will show how all of my systems are communicating with each other. And just to kind of show that things are happening at different times, this is Wireshark. So I'm going to use it to kind of show you what some of the traffic looks like, okay?
All right. So we can see the traffic flow, so we can see what kind of protocols are flowing, and you've got the screen, which is showing us available clients.
Yep. So where we're going to start earlier, I created a malicious Microsoft Office document, okay? And I could make this document download the malware entirely over DNS or download Beacon just with a quick HTTP GET. And for time, we're going to do the HTTP GET, but that's not going to affect us much. So let me go ahead and grab this document and open it up.
So you just sent this document as an attachment, or perhaps you've given it to someone and they've just opened it on their computer.
Correct. And this is the target that you're seeing right now. So my target, up-to-date Windows 7 system, it's got antivirus, all that good stuff. The user just received a document that has macros in it. Now, if they were fortunate enough for us to click enable content, you see that big purple thing?
That's beaconed.
Yeah, that's the compromised system downloading the beacon. Now, over in my tech console, I see a blank line. This is the DNS beacon. Right now, the beacon is every 60 seconds calling home with a DNS A record request. And that's its way of asking me, the attacker, if I have anything for it to do. So what we're going to do is I'm going to interact with this beacon, and I'm going to tell it when it communicates with me next, use DNS text records and start calling home on a 10-second interval. So now, in about 15 seconds, this beacon is going to check in and run any commands I give it. So I'm going to give it just several Windows commands, things I could type in a command shell. And what you're going to see is when it checks in, do you see the green line for DNS traffic?
So it's just made a link.
It just made a link. And this is not the peer-to-peer stuff yet. This is a compromised workstation beaconing back, okay? And the reason it's called beacon is because right now it's beaconing. We don't see anything in the traffic view because it's only communicating with us every 10 seconds, a lot like real malware. And it could do a beacon once a day, once an hour, whatever is best for me, the attacker.
Right. So if I've got a system that I'm really not going to be using for everyday attacks, but rather I want to save that network, I want to save that compromised network for some operation down the line, I could say, look, only beacon once a month, and that will really reduce the chances that someone will discover you.
Yes, this is what your advanced persistent threat type actors do. When they get into a network, they dig into a few key hosts that allow them to retake any other part of the network they want to later, and then they go low and slow. They say beacon back once a week or beacon back once a day. And however good anyone's intrusion detection or however well instrumented their network is, I don't think anyone's going to notice one DNS A record request per day. That's pretty tough.
Right, yeah, because it's going to look just like a DNS request. Someone's not, I mean, even if they've got deep packet inspection on, they're probably not paying close enough attention to spot that one errant DNS packet.
Yep, and this is right here, the actual beacon DNS request happening. But what we're going to do now is let's go interactive, meaning I, the attacker, I need to do some stuff on your network. And ideally, I would do this at night when hopefully most of the network defense staff is not at work, because I don't like getting caught or disrupted when I'm working. And I'm going to change my communication channel. I'm going to change my communication channel to HTTP. And this is going to now make my traffic look like when it checks in next. This is going to make my traffic look like web traffic. And so give that a moment. And there you go. You can see that purple HTTP connection between my compromised system and Amazon's Elastic Computing Cloud. Now, this is going to get fun. We're going to stage a popular open source remote administration tool called Meterpreter. I'm just going to type Meterpreter and press enter. And what you're going to see is this purple line, which is solid because we're checking in multiple times a second, is going to go very thick in a few seconds because Meterpreter is downloading. Okay, and it's about a megabyte in size. But once that Meterpreter session comes back, we are going to have our lightning bolts. This system is compromised. And it was compromised when we had Beacon on it in the first place, but now we can do everything I showed you in the previous episodes where we're able to take screenshots, and you can see there's the Word document that the user opened. And, you know, that's all well and good. Now, let's use this foothold to burrow deeper into this network, okay? What I'm going to do is set up something called a pivot, telling Meterpreter to become a hop point for further things I'm about to do. So now I've added a pivot saying, hey, anytime I try to access these hosts, do so through this Meterpreter session, which is riding through our beacon. And by the way, I can make Meterpreter ride over DNS. So when I change that data channel, you're going to see that purple line disappear. Now we've got a green line. Compromised system going to my domain controller, which is also my internal DNS server, going to my router, which is then going out to the internet to reach me, the attacker.
Now, Rafael, one of the things about this attack is you can dynamically switch the links, right? I mean, you can link and unlink clients as necessary, so you could always be switching the paths that your traffic is taking.
Yeah, and that's actually what I'm about to show. So let me go ahead and do that. What I need to do next is drop beacons on some of these systems inside this network, okay? So I'm going to do that right now. First, I'm just going to do a quick sweep for a certain service for SMB so I can learn a little bit more about these targets. And this is kind of a necessary step before I can use my tools to deliver what I call a passive beacon. And a passive beacon is like a one-time use, or not one-time use, it's like a backdoor that I can connect back to at any point by linking a beaconing system to it. And that's going to become very visible in this diagram in a moment. So what I'm going to do is, let's do this. Just change my sorting a little bit. Oops, I'll do it like this. What I'm going to do is deliver a beacon to this Windows 8 system. And I'm going to skip the actual hacking and recovering tokens part. I'm just going to use a username and password to put beacon on this Windows 8 system.
Right, so we've assumed that they've infected their computer. They've compromised it. You're just sort of taking a shortcut right now.
Yeah, I'm spreading from a beachhead is what I'm doing. Right. But I'm taking a shortcut to do that. So let me go ahead and deliver a beacon to that system, 192.168.83. And let's go ahead and hit launch. And what's kind of neat by this is I'm actually using a hacker version of PSExec that will deliver a payload, we call it, but bootstrap it with PowerShell so it gets past antivirus. And that is assuming, okay, now everything's looking really good, good. Because we're doing this over a beacon, this is taking a moment, but there you can see SMB is the red. Or actually, that was a random, that was the payload being downloaded. But now, that system, 192.168.83, that we just dropped a backdoor on, we're not communicating with it yet, right?
Right.
Let's go ahead and link to it. Let's go interact. Let's do a link to 192.168.83. And now, we've established a link with that child. And let's go ahead and interact with it. Let's go to our beacon on that system and let's just do a DIR, a directory listing. Do you see how Microsoft
so we, now, we, if I make, With that pivot, you've basically been able to take over the machine. You could do anything that a user...
take over the machine.
Yeah. You can do anything that a user would be able to do sitting in front of that machine.
But what's neat is my communication to that compromised system is SMB traffic. So let's see here. I got SMB or DNS here.
Right. So if you were trying to do a forensic analysis of this attack, let's say they figure out at some point that there's that the computer's been compromised, there's a pivot running on it, they would get back to the systems that you've connected through over that standard protocol. But I mean, I could see this being almost impossible to trace back to where the attack traffic originated from.
It's not impossible. So what happens here is when you see that's the actual staging meterpreter through a beacon onto that Windows 8 system. So you can see it actually, because we're doing something noisy, there's a lot of activity taking place. So it's not impossible to see, but what it is it becomes very difficult because now my path as an attacker is getting more and more obfuscated.
Right, right.
And I'm being very noisy on purpose because I want you to see this actual path.
Right, you're demoing it for us. But if, I mean, imagine this network right now that we're seeing, but with all the regular traffic traveling through a network. I don't I don't exactly know how you'd find it. Cheebert, I want to throw over to you for a second because this is being mentioned in the chat room that really the defense against this is to stop it from ever being ever infecting, right? Stopping that first point of infection, stopping that beachhead from happening. But then you're fighting user habits, and how successful has that been?
Hey, I just had a researcher in China try to open up a connection and got nabbed by a man in the middle attack, and they got his credentials. So, yeah. And he, you know, he's actually a fairly educated user. So the answer to your question is, oh my God, I'm in deep kimchi.
Got it. Okay. Rafael, let's continue this. So we've now got a beachhead. We're now dynamically making links. We've now been able to pivot one of the computers. Right. Where else are you going with this?
Okay, let me take this just another step to kind of take you through what I want to show you. And the main idea here of what I want to show you is this concept of not just that I've got a beachhead system that's egressing to the internet, and through that beachhead, I can control every other compromised system. But when I'm controlling those compromised systems, I'm doing so with what looks like Windows file sharing traffic. So I'm just killing my Wireshark filter here just so you can kind of see it happening. And this SMB2 is our connection between 172.168.80, the beachhead, and 83, which is that linked workstation, okay? Now let's go ahead and expand our links a little bit further. And we're going to do that kind of dynamic linking and unlinking that you were talking about just a moment ago. So first, let's come over here and let's link in a system I just compromised, which is 172.168.81. So I'm going to link to it, 172.168.81. And I've got a link, but I'm not doing anything with it yet, so it doesn't show. So let me do something noisy with it. Let's go right-click, interact. And let me just grab a shell. And you can see this system egressing through our beachhead, right? Like you saw the path. Let me grab a meterpreter session. And you can see how that link is starting to light up. And it looks like this is the Microsoft Windows file sharing traffic between the beachhead and this system. And in a moment, we're going to get a meterpreter session. And that is about to occur. And that system's going to get its lightning bolts as soon as this download happens.
There you go. Okay, so it's got the download. It's installing.
We've got our lightning bolts. So we've established control over this compromised system. Okay, now we're there. Good. Now what I'm going to do, I'm going to pull up a command shell on that system. And one of the ways people are successfully finding attackers is through NetFlows, kind of seeing this patient zero and saying, who talked to it? But let's say I want to kind of mess with somebody who's looking at who's talking to what by changing some of these links up on the fly. And that's what I want to do next.
Okay. So in other words, if they were trying to forensically analyze this attack by saying, okay, this was my compromised machine, who talked to the machine, I can actually change the path of the communications to make it look like it's an incontrovertible linkage of computers.
Yeah, I can make it so my entire peer-to-peer network of compromised systems stops talking out to the internet through the initial beachhead, and I can use a new beachhead. And that's what I'm going to activate right now.
All right.
So here's what give me one moment, because here's what I've got. I'm going to take over 172.168.3, and I've got to do this fast to keep my meterpreter sessions alive, although I can always re-request them. But this demo is a lot cooler when I bring them up. So I'm going to take and make this beacon, which is my domain controller. It could be any system, really. Interactive. And I'm going to just tell it to establish a SMB session with my initial beachhead, which was 80. Let's see. We're going to do this. And the reason I have to do this is because right now I have control of this particular system as a system user, but not a domain user. So I have to actually, to use this beacon SMB backdoor, I have to be a normal network user or have a session with that host. So when this system checks in about, okay, there we go, we're good. So now what I'm going to do, let's take my beachhead, 172.168.80, and let's turn it into, let's make it go silent. Let's make it into a passive beacon. And you're going to notice my whole peer-to-peer network of compromised systems went dark, right?
Right, right.
Nothing's talking. Now, let's go ahead and take another beachhead, and let's relink in that peer-to-peer network. Oops, I forgot to change the sleep time. Oh, no, I did. Okay, good.
There we go.
And do you see how it comes back alive? But do you see the beachhead is now different?
Right. So once they're no now if they looked at it, they would be able to track the original beachhead.
No, because I've just changed to another system. But what's funny is my other compromised systems are completely unaware that this happened, even though they're using this strange peer-to-peer network to tunnel everything out of.
So theoretically, any compromised system within the network could become your beachhead. You could just
absolutely
move it. Oh, wow. Okay, Chibert, let me ask you about this, because one of the ways to kill off a botnet network has been to hunt for the command and control network. If my command and control network is always moving around like this, how much more difficult does it make it to kill it off?
Bloody impossible, actually.
Okay.
Talk about the ultimate way of framing up someone, too.
Right, yeah. So, yo, Raphael, I could move traffic to someone's client, someone's computer, if I would prefer to have suspicion cast on them, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the power of this technique, is it gives you the ability to change up your command and control network on the fly. But even better, I, the attacker, can unlink my network, my peer-to-peer network of compromised systems, and leave, go to sleep. And I can come back to your network later through that beacon that's coming back once a month. And I can relink to that network and suddenly have interactive control of all those systems again, even though only one system is actually beaconing out.
Nice. Raphael, thank you so very much for showing us this beacon. You're going to come back again, and I'm assuming you're going to find something else scary that's going to make us all go crazy and throw our hands in the air. Now, just let me ask you really quickly, if you were trying to defend against this sort of attack into your network, what are some solid steps that you would want to take?
Okay, first, always make an assumption that an attacker is going to get a beachhead somehow.
Okay.
So it's really helpful to invest in your network security monitoring. Have a team that is looking for anomalies, looking for why is the system communicating with a random server in China, or why is this workstation connecting to the web at 3 a.m? Okay. Another thing to detect the anomalous DNS traffic. The other thing you can do is look at volume. why is a workstation making a request to this domain? Why are they making more than 5 kilobytes a day of DNS traffic to this particular domain? And don't ignore DNS. DNS is an awesome command and control channel. And something I'm finding is when I go on exercises to actually help people test their ability to detect these threats, I find nobody's looking at DNS very well right now. And so I definitely think looking at volume of DNS traffic to a domain is something that could be very helpful in finding advanced burrowed in threats like this.
Chibert, I want to give the last word over to you. You've been quietly, I've been watching you on the preview screen. You've been quietly watching this with dread. We know that a deep packet inspection monitor will absolutely be necessary. You need to look past the protocols and actually look past the headers into the payload itself. But aside from what Rafael has already mentioned, looking at anomalous patterns of traffic, or maybe looking for traffic at hours that traffic shouldn't be sent, is there anything else that you think system administrators could do to mitigate a beacon-compromised network? And again, we're going to assume that you can't stop the beachhead, because at some point someone's going to make that mistake, download that program that they shouldn't, read that document that they shouldn't have, enable that macro they shouldn't have, and get that initial beachhead.
Yeah, I think the big issue here is how do you give your monitoring systems enough attention to be able to recognize these kinds of patterns? I've already sent off some email and some links to my buddy at SonicMall saying, let's go try this and see if the IPS is going to catch it. I am not sure it will. But considering how deep SonicWall goes in with their IPS, I'd call it maybe a 50-50 chance it'll catch it. But yeah, this is really scary stuff, and you're totally right. You've got to stop that initial beachhead, but how are you going to stop that initial beachhead when it's all about social engineering, getting your users to stop freaking clicking on those ads?
Stop freaking clicking. I like that. That could be a show title. Now, I want to thank all of the people who made this episode possible. You've gone ahead and wasted another hour. Well, I shouldn't say wasted. I'd say gifted in the spirit of the holiday season to a show that 9 out of 10 popes say, let us all be quiet. That's priest style. But I do want to thank my panelists for coming on the show, for being part of this. Let's start with you, Chibert. What are the things that the Twiat Riot should know about you?
Oh, they can always find me on Twitter. I'm ADVNETLAB. But Twiat Riot, be careful, because we're going to try and get something that people can actually remember. I'm going to make an attempt in the new year to move to Chibert, Hawaii, instead of that original Twitter handle.
Absolutely. Chibert, Hawaii, not bad. Curtis Franklin, it's a pleasure to be able to spend this wonderful pre-Christmas episode with you. Tell us what's going on at Enterprise Efficiency, especially in the coming year.
Padre, we're looking at doing some great things at Enterprise Efficiency in the coming year. One of them is more E2 radio, which our community has said they love. We've got all kinds of new audio spots coming up. New guests, new ways of talking and telling the stories of CIOs and enterprise managers. You know, people are doing some amazing things with computers these days. And I'm looking forward to bringing you their stories. And I also want to say that I'm looking forward to continuing here at Twiat. I really value being part of the entire Twiat community and of this fabulous team you've put together. I hope that everyone is having a great holiday season, whichever holiday you're celebrating here, as the light returns after the darkness of the solstice.
Oh, may the light return with you, my friend. Also, I really, really want to thank Rafael for coming back on. You have become the security Grinch. You're the guy who reminds us exactly how insecure our networks are, even if we think that we're at the top of our game. Rafael, where can the Twiat Riot find you, and what are you doing these days?
Sure. I'm Rafael Mudge, a Washington, D.C.-based entrepreneur. I don't know. No, I run a security company. I build software for pen testers. A product called Cobalt Strike is the main thing I work on. If you want to learn more about what I do, go to www.advancedpentest.com.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. And of course, I want to thank you, the Twiat Riot. This has been an absolutely fantastic, fantastic ride. And you know what? It's looking like we're going to have many good things in the year to come. I want to wish you and all your families a merry, merry Christmas, holiday season, whatever it is that you celebrate. And I want to give you a little bit of a gift. I want to give you a way to get every episode of Twiat into your device of choice. And you can do that by going to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find a little drop-down box that will let you choose your device of choice. You want Twiat on your iPad? Of course you can. You want it on your iPod? You want it on your iPhone? We'll make it possible for you to get it on your PC, your Mac, your Zombie Zune. Any way you want it, that's the way you get it. That reminds me of a song I once heard. Also, did you know that we have a YouTube page? That's right. If you go to youtube.com/Twiat, you'll find not only all of our episodes, but also all of our segments. And big announcement, in the new year, we will actually be having hangouts. That's right. Chibert, myself, Curtis, some of the guys are going to come in and just shoot the breeze. If you've ever watched our show live, you'll know that some of the greatest moments of Twiat have come before and after the episode. Well, now we're going to give you a way to experience that, even if you can't watch us live. Which, by the way, you should be doing every Monday at noon Pacific time. You can come to live.twit.tv and find Twiat live. And you can see the pre-show and the post-show and all the mess-ups. It's watching how the sausage is made. It's part of the experiment that is Twiat and Twit itself. Now, speaking of the Twit experiment, we also have a chat room at irc.twit.tv. Go ahead and log in during the live show. You'll see me calling out people from the chat room. You could participate with some of the greatest trolls, some of the funniest people, and some of the brightest members of the Twit army. Finally, I want to thank everyone here in the Brick House who makes this show possible, to Karsten, to Jason, my normal TD, to Brian, my super big doge TD. And I want to call out to you, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiat.